This week, we all get schooled. Welcome to the Midwest Peace Process.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I have the pleasure to present to you now. Ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I have the pleasure to present to you.
The Midwest Peace Process.
The world is very different now.
The Midwest Peace.
To remind
Process.
America of the fierce urgency of now. 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 Now.
Welcome now. To episode 15. Today is January 12th, 2012. Happy New Year to all of our listeners. I'm Jerry.
I'm Jeremy.
And this is Rob.
And we are back after a long holiday hiatus. We are ready to tackle the new year with some new topics and hopefully some new gimmicks to get our listeners to listen.
That's what it takes, gimmicks.
That's right. We're all about the gimmicks. But seriously, we live on your feedback. And we're always looking for ways to make it easier for you to reach us. So you can visit our website, MidwestPeaceProcess.com, and leave us a comment or send a note to feedback at MidwestPeaceProcess.com. Or you can comment on our Facebook page, of course, Facebook.com/MidwestPeace. I'm happy to welcome a special guest on our show this evening. This is Bill. Say hi, Bill.
Hi, Bill. I'm special.
Of course you are. We're all special.
At least my mother thinks so.
That's good. You got one on your side.
So Bill is a avid listener. He has a, I guess, a special stake in our topic, our main event topic this time. We're going to be talking about education. Public education, and Bill has a rant or two to get off his chest, so we invited him on to join us and hopefully make the discussion a little more lively.
Am I also that gimmick?
I wasn't going to come right out and say it, Bill, but yes.
Wow. It's impressive. A gimmick and special in one evening.
So, let's not waste any time. Let's roll right into the main event.
Let's get ready to ramble!
As I said, our topic this evening is education, public education. And let me just say up front that that much of my opinion on public school is informed by the writings of John Taylor Gatto. And I've included a link in the show notes to his website. But Gatto was named New York State Teacher of the Year after being named New York City Teacher of the Year on three different occasions. He quit teaching on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal in 1991 while still New York State Teacher of the Year, claiming that he no longer was willing to hurt children. Later that year, he was the subject of a show at Carnegie Hall called An Evening with John Taylor Gatto, which launched a career of public speaking in the area of school reform. And his books include Dumbing Us Down and The Underground History of American Education. So I bring that up because one of the main points that Gatto makes in most of his books is that education and schooling are not the same thing. And education is something one pursues for one's own benefit. Schooling is something that is forced upon us in an effort to indoctrinate or brainwash. So as Gatto points out, public school isn't broken. And he says that because it does exactly what it was designed to do, and that is crank out a steady stream of automatons that are trained to follow orders and not question their assigned role within a factory or, you know, some other industry. So school works just fine. It can't be fixed because it's not broken. So I was hoping on this episode that we could start a conversation about how we educate our children, and if we think that public school is the way to do it, how do we fix what needs to be fixed? So I'll just open it up to anyone of you guys. Feel free to jump in.
I'm sure there's some expectation of me ranting at this point. but let me first give a little background. My opinions on education or public schooling, more specifically, are not informed by anything other than my experience as a public education participant myself, and the fact that I have two children who are currently part of the system. I found in what you've shared with the gentleman who informs your decisions that I probably agree a whole lot with his description that public education isn't broken and that it's doing what it's designed to do. But I think my question is more on, does what it's designed to do even matter anymore? I don't know that we need to have an assembly line of stooges coming out to do menial tasks to make minimum wage any longer. But then today's job market proves that we also don't need an assembly line production of college graduates either. So I wonder where we go with what we've got now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, you mentioned about education and schooling, and that's when you got to be careful when you get into career training, because I think we can agree that education isn't the same as career training. Otherwise, we'd have Excel class in third grade, which I wholeheartedly support.
Which I can assure you that my children are now taking.
I can't do anything without an Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah,
a shopping list. I need a spreadsheet for this.
I have two children as well, and neither one of them are in public school. However, we've chosen to homeschool. But I do remember reading a couple of years ago that some school district in Michigan, I think it was requiring their, before you could even enter kindergarten, they gave you a test with a computer to make sure that the child knew how to use a mouse.
Wow.
Yeah. So I thought, wow, they're okay. They're getting them started early.
Do they have to have a password before they can, learn to read? That's right. The thing that scares me. Sorry, Timmy. You've forgotten your password. You can't remember.
That's right.
So do we need to think about the what the whole purpose of the education is? Are we all down with education? Education a good thing?
I'm going to say that I think education is a good thing, but I think the whole conversation that's occurring in the bigger sphere out there is that education equals job training. I think President Obama believes that education equals job training. I think a lot of parents think education equals job training.
Right. Right.
I don't know how you're going to get any education reform when people don't even understand what education is.
So what are you saying education should be? Not so much the job training part? Because I agree with you about the education equals job training. I think we've put those two together too much. I was a music major, and sometimes people would say, I can't believe they train all these musicians and then there's no jobs for them. It's like, there's not their job to provide jobs for the musicians. It's their job to teach them how to play. You know, if that's what you want to do, that's what you want to do. So they educated me as best they could. And if I wasn't good enough to get a job, that's my own fault, you know? So, but there is that feeling like it's somehow the college's responsibility to be able to provide a job for the people that they train. Well, it's not a job training program. It's college.
Yeah.
Correct.
Right. And that's true with all sorts of stuff.
I found the same thing as an English major in a small liberal arts college.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I know. I understand. No. But
come on. I was a music guy.
Well, at least you went to a big school. My school was tiny. But I was somewhat of an oddity in that I at least had sought out that there might be career opportunities outside teaching English.
Right.
You know, that I might be able to do something else other than follow the master's PhD program. People in that program didn't understand that there were options other than becoming an Englisher at the other end of that degree.
Right. And maybe this goes back, maybe we'll bring this back to the elementary school world, but I had the same thing happen in both the music and my math world, is that you're dealing with people that only know their music and their math world, and they're, or English or whatever it is, they're the people that do that field. So they're not the most objective observers or providers of advice about how to do things that aren't in their little field. Correct. And so you ask them, what should I do? And they're like, well, perhaps grad school. You know, it's the only thing that they could come up with, you know?
Agreed.
So does that come down to the elementary school too? Like, do the teachers just know how to teach fractions and they can't see the big picture?
I question if all of them know how to teach fractions. I think that might be part of it. That I think part is that you've got the lunatics guarding the asylum, right? You've got people who have a vested interest in things staying the way they are now, running things.
In what way? Are you giving it some union type stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I am not anti-union. My mother was a shop steward, for God's sakes. So let's not say that. But I believe that that the NEA has a vested interest in keeping teachers paying their union dues. And I think that things like teachers being graded for performance and paid based on performance and hired and fired based on performance frightens them, because then there might not be as many people paying their union dues. But I don't think the union is the root of all evil. I think it's, you know, there's a whole subculture of education reformers. I subscribe to some of their Twitter feeds, as boring as that may sound. But
it's like the most boring Twitter feed. hashtag.
It is not quite as exciting as some others, but there are people there, and there are the anti-union, there are the pro-union, there are the anti-standardized testing, there are the pro-standardized testing, there are it's the parents' fault people, there are the it's not the parents' fault people. So for each possible suggestion of education, public schooling changes, let's not say education changes, but public schooling changes, there is an anti or pro of that. And right. I just don't think that people even get the fact that the whole assumption is wrong. You know, you almost feel like
hit this thesis. What's the assumption that's wrong?
The assumption that's wrong is that we need to continue locking small children into 12x12 rooms to sit in desks to be taught how to behave before they are taught the goods, because their behavior is more important than their learning.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Is that a good enough thesis?
And I would also say that the large majority of the problems that schools have to deal with and that the teachers have to deal with on a day-to-day basis are a result of kids being there who don't want to be there.
Correct.
Why
don't they want to be there? Do they not want to be there because they're forced to sit and do rote memorization? Or do they not want to be there because they've got issues at home? I don't know what that answer is, but
I think there are a lot of different answers, and I think part of it is at home – they have an Xbox at home or a Wii at home, and that's
correct.
Pretty awesome. And you're gonna show me a picture of Christopher Columbus and talk about how important that was? Forget that. I'll go play Modern Warfare 3.
Right.
I know I'm dating myself, but I used to have the film strip projectors with a record on them, and then some noise would go boop, and the teacher would turn.
We still had those.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes it wasn't the teacher, like the little suck up kid. We get to move the. Hate that kid.
Hey, to move well, the you know that was wasn't actually a point I was going to make was that
Jeremy was that suck up kid.
I wasn't a suck up. I just knew how to behave. I guess I was the prototypical. Hey, he's a good little soldier. But my friend Eddie and I, we were allowed to do that in the class. We ran. They taught us how to run the projectors and. And that was in fifth grade, I think. So, you know, we had some experience under our belt. But there was...
Which served you well as president of the AV club in high school?
Nah, I was too big in the band to be in the AV club. But
yes, us band kids that, looked out on the AV club. For sure.
Point of that was, it was kind of an incentive, at least for me, because I thought that kind of stuff was cool. I thought it was interesting to learn how to run this machine. And now little Jimmy cut his finger on the video reel, so we're going to sue the school. So now we got to make a rule that no children can touch the machine.
Right. They can't be within 15 feet of it.
Yeah. So, kind of took things off on a tangent there. But
that's a good tangent, though, Jeremy. I mean, there are kids that are interested in audiovisual equipment, right?
Right.
There are kids that are interested in basketball. They're not always the same kid, you know? And I think there's got to be some way to let those kids explore their interest and learn as their interests develop. And that will be an education instead of schooling. Maybe there are some core concepts that you need to know, like reading and writing and arithmetic. We've all heard those. But does my child need to learn four different ways to solve a subtraction problem? Because some kids don't get the problem way 1, 2, and 3. My kid comes home and he doesn't know how to solve subtraction anymore, and he's been doing it for 3 years, and it's because he's confused on which model he's supposed to use to subtract. You know what I'm saying? When you're teaching the very lowest common denominator there, and you have to make everything 3 or 4 times as difficult as it needs to be to reach everyone, what are you serving there?
That's probably pointing to a larger problem that everything, they want it to be one size fits all.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And people just don't work that way.
Right. Nope. At its core, that is, in my opinion, the entire problem with public school is it tries to be the one size fits all solution, and every kid is a special case, and the system just can't deal with that. It's a shotgun method aimed at 80% of the class, and the top 10% that would normally be excelling beyond the teacher's expectations, they're frustrated because they're being held back. Mm-hmm. And then the 10%, at the bottom end are struggling because they don't understand what's going on. And so they're dragging everybody else down. And, I'm probably being generous by saying there's 80% in the middle. It's probably more like 30% in the middle, mm-hmm. and 35% on either side. But yeah, that's the problem. I mean, you can only go as fast as the slowest student in class.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one way you could fix that in the same public school model is just have more teachers. If you had more teachers, more classrooms, your classroom of 28 would now be a classroom of 7 if you had 4 mm-hmm. teachers.
Okay.
And you could take those seven kids who are struggling and create a whole class for them. You could take the 7 who are advanced, create a whole class for them. So let's pour more money in the public school system. Solved and checkmate.
Let's not.
No, I mean, you did make – I know this is going to shock everyone on the show, but, Rob, you did make a very valid point the other day that when it's teachers teaching that make the difference in whether or not it's schooling or education, right?
Right.
So I agree that if we had more teachers, we might be able to reach more students at their level. But that brings my next big thesis, which is the funding model is broken, right? That you can't ask people who don't give a damn about public education to vote to pay more for it when they're already not getting a perceived value from it because we're getting such low standardized test scores in the first place, right?
Right. Yeah, we like to reference Chris Rock a lot on this show, and this brings to mind another one of his quotes. Where,
I don't got no kids. Why am I paying school tax? I know some of y'all got kids. You think I give a f*** how dumb your children are?
Well, I just... It sickens me. What is the average? About $11,500 per student in the United States that we spend. My school district is much below that, and that's a source of shame to them. But they do okay. But $11,500 is a lot of money.
Yeah.
But if you go seek out alternatives to the public education system, which I have done, you're talking almost double that out of your own pocket, and you still have to pay.
Right. Taxes. You're paying for schools you're not using.
Correct. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's awesome.
So it's a bargain.
That was a chant or a cheer that one of the local Catholic high schools used to do to us. It would say, "We paid for your school."
Nice.
Well, I guess you're the idiots.
Right. But
Jeremy provided a couple of links that I've got in the show notes to a woman named Marva Collins. And I just remember in one of those links, they mentioned that $11,000 figure. And she's well known for having started a private school in Chicago that succeeded in teaching all of these low income, you know, the students that other teachers had claimed were, you know, some of them thought they were even learning disabled. They were, you know, she was able to reach these kids and, you know, actually give them an education. And, you know, she was spending less, I think it was less than $5,000 per student. So I don't believe it's about the money. I don't think it's ever been about the money. And Rob, I know you were joking before when you said that, but that does seem to be the battle cry. You know, every time we get into this discussion about what's wrong with the schools, the answer is throw more money at it.
Let's talk about funding for a second, or for a minute, however long. I'm in the Pattonville School District. Mm-hmm. Pattonville High School is 5 minutes from me. They just built a brand new stadium and a pool at the school. Great for the kids, right? We have a casino here that supplies all kinds of funding for them, theoretically. They still send kids around door to door selling Christmas cards, candy, and whatever else. I don't slam the door on the kids because, hey, they're just doing what they were asked to do and
right,
polite, and even every now and then buy something if I know the kid. But it really, when I started thinking about it, it really hacks me off that there's something doesn't match up there to me.
Well, yeah. I think in all things that aren't maybe a private business there, I mean, there's always going to be the endless asking for money, no matter what it is, whether it's Red Cross or Salvation Army or, you know, whatever it is, there's always going to be a drive for more. You know, it's not like you give to Red Cross and they're like, sweet, thanks a lot, we're all set now, you know?
Yeah, but it's not a charity model.
Right.
I mean, it's the mugger holding the gun and saying, give me your wallet. And then when he's done, he asks you for a donation on top of that.
Right, right. If you're mad about what you're already paying, I can see it that way.
Well, I would imagine that, I mean, I always thought it was a good thing to pay my taxes, you know, because I was paying for a school district that even though before I had children I wasn't using – I assumed I was going to get benefit from, but can you imagine being 80 years old and being asked to up your real estate taxes, which is probably the only bill you have, but it's going to throw you over the edge when you're not even using it? I think that that's broken.
You don't even have to be 80, right? I mean,
you could be
40 and childless.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's the same thing.
Correct. You could be a homeschooler and be ticked off.
Well, there's that too.
Yeah.
The argument would be that, well, it's a fee you're paying to not get your house vandalized by delinquent children, but that's still happening. That's still happening. So it doesn't.
This is the Jerry.
Don't even say it again.
Riot insurance, Mike.
Yes. It's riot insurance.
I'll have to admit, that is the first time you ever offended me when I listened to the podcast. The second time I told you to suck it or whatever.
Riot insurance, that was offensive.
It was, because I'm a participant in that riot insurance, I guess. I mean, really, do you really think that the reason the public school system exists is to prevent riots by angry mobs of parents and...
Well, no,
I wouldn't say parents. I would say kids just not having anything better to do than, hey, let's go set that on fire and see what happens.
So it's like a juvenile detention home for the possible?
I use that argument to... I use that argument to kind of illustrate for those that would say that, you know, we all benefit from the public education system because, you know, we're educating all these people and that way they can go out and get jobs and be productive members of society instead of resorting to crime, you know, and that if we didn't pay for public education, that everybody would just be a bunch of layabouts that were, you know, running around holding each other up or vandalizing, you know, it would just be rioting in the streets. Okay. And I don't
explained
buy that.
Like that, I can kind of see where you're coming from. I still don't like my child's alma mater being called riot insurance, but I do understand. But I don't. I also think that that's a failed assumption that there will be mass hysteria if we close the public schools.
Yes.
There will be massive social change because I don't know what the percentage is, but a heck of a lot of dual income couples will rapidly become single income couples so that they can now adapt to the taxed daycare that is provided, you know, as far as allowing both parents to work or even single parents to work and not have to pay for child care during that time.
That's an interesting point because, you know, they recently here, I'm in Parkway mm-hmm. School District. They recently, just this year, in fact, they're offering all day kindergarten for, mm-hmm. You know, students that live in the district. And that was following some discussion within the district of making preschool mandatory. And I know there were a lot of people that, you know, were in favor of both of those things. And it was for that reason. They were like, hey, really? That would be awesome. You know, that's one less year of daycare I have to pay for. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, half as much daycare during their year in kindergarten that I have to pay for. And I think that's sad that there are parents that are thinking that way, you know. No.
Especially when they have, I'm sure they're done by liberal think tanks and communists all over the place. But the studies have been showing that, you know, if you do start some type of education at pre-kindergarten or kindergarten, that there are some benefits to the child. But it's a shame that our culture thinks that, ooh, free daycare.
Right.
There are definite benefits, but that's the job of the parents. And that's another place another area where we're falling down, parents not being parents. And that goes from preschool, you know, from birth all the way through high school. Parents not doing what they're supposed to be doing to raise a responsible adult, or I guess rear is the correct term. But
right. No, you're right. That's absolutely true. But I think that's a parallel problem, really, to, you know, the school issue. But where it crosses over is the involvement of the parent in the child's education, even if they are going to a public school. Mm-hmm. I think there are too many parents that are willing to just, you know, throw their hands up and say, well, you're going to public school. I don't need to educate you because that's the teacher's job. You know, I don't want or need to be involved in this. And that's not true. I mean, all the studies have shown the kids who do the best in school are the ones whose parents are actively involved. Correct. And so
go ahead. I kind of enjoy being a thorn in people's side and my elementary school. I like walking.
Involved to what extent, though?
Well, I've
heard the term helicopter parents. That's the new thing.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, there's
all things in moderation, right?
Yeah, including moderation.
I'm surprised that I'm like the least cynical on this issue.
Because you don't have a child in the school system yet.
Well, I don't either.
Oh, well, Jeremy's just cynical because it's across the street from him, and he wants to swim in that new pool.
Keep going up there. They keep throwing me out.
Well, okay, so how do you think we're being cynical, Rob?
Well, I think, I mean, doesn't it have some benefit? I mean, one thing I think about is that we're talking about just the idea of how do you gauge the health of a nation or health of a group of people. And I think one is this idea of some level of education for most people. Like, I always think about, like, how are we going to compete with the Chinese in the space war? You know, you don't really need a public school for that. You just need a few smart dorks out there that know a lot of math, and you could school those Chinese guys. You don't need a whole system for that. So why do you need a whole system? Is I think you need a base level of education for a workforce that can handle that. And I know our education system's not doing great, but I think one thing that has put our country ahead of some other nations, like with the cheap labor, like as the manufacturing is kind of progressed technologically, like we're no longer just putting eyelets in a shoe anymore to do that manufacturing job, which used to be a low education blue collar job. You need some sense of how technology works, and you need a high level of education. And I think they're finding that the dude in Bhutan, wherever Bhutan is, it's just a country I thought of,
I'll put a link in the show notes.
Doesn't have that level of education as in the basic workforce. And so, yeah, they're willing to work cheaper, but are you willing to let that guy run your million-dollar robot to help put the car on the – put the door on the car? You know, so I think that it's an example. I mean, we could always do better, but it's an example where the U.S. is outpacing, you know, the rest of the world in those situations.
But what measure are you seeing that we are outpacing anyone in anything other than debt and personal fat levels? you know what I'm saying? By what yardstick are you using?
I don't have a yardstick. I go by metric.
I mean, we have what, 10 million unemployed? How many millions underemployed? How many people who've given up even seeking gainful employment?
I'm not saying we're doing well. That's not what I'm saying.
Okay.
We're obviously not doing well. And obviously we could do better, but I don't see it as a wasteful investment, or even the idea being wasteful.
Okay. But the presumption in what you're saying is, in the absence of this public system that we all pay for, we would have a nation of what, morons that, you know, can't perform basic tasks that are asked of them, or you know, can't read, can't write. That,
yes.
And, well, this goes back to, I think it was the very first episode of the show when I brought up the statistic that got us all bogged down about literacy rates back in 1850. Mm-hmm. And I won't go off on that tangent again. I'll just say that, you know, this was a very literate nation for, you know, 100, 150 years before the very first public school ever opened. So somehow we managed to educate generations of people in this country without a public school system. And I think that would continue to be true if, you know, if we shut everything down tomorrow. Because people have a natural curiosity. They want to be educated. It's just they want to be educated about what they want to be educated about. So they're going to find their passion and they're going to find a way to learn what they want to learn, whether that be, you know, a private school that they pay for out of their pocket, or it's, you know, homeschooling where, or some sort of co-op where, you know, the parents get together and, you know, hire a teacher to teach their kids, or, you know, whatever system you could dream up. I think that's going to happen spontaneously in the absence of a public education system.
Now, here's where I get cynical. Here's my cynical moment. I just don't think that would happen. I think the parents who would join a co-op group and set up an educational program for their buddies and their friends' kids, like, those kids would be fine no matter what.
Correct.
I think that kids with those kind of parents and those sorts of resources, you could homeschool them, you could send them to public school, you send them to private school, upside down school, it doesn't matter, they're going to be fine. And as well as there's other, that's 5 minutes from my house. You know, and then you have the other kids that, man, you could spend millions of dollars and it's not going to happen for those kids.
Yeah.
And they're on the other end of the bell curve. I'm talking about the big juicy middle.
Okay.
And I don't think that big juicy middle would get educated without a public –
without being forced to be educated.
Exactly.
Okay. And
I don't even know that you have to – you know, I'm occasionally for pitchforks and torches. Let's just get that out there. But I don't know that we need to burn every public school to the ground and say no more, no more. I'm just – wondering if there isn't a better way to sustain kids' natural curiosity so they can learn what they want to learn.
All right. I'll tell you how to do it.
How?
I know how.
Don't say more funding again.
No, it better not be more money.
Yeah, here's a good example to think about how you would do this. And okay. And it might bring us to the next topic here. But the way I've seen this work the best is that you get some map tests. You have some things that you have to cover. You have to cover fractions. You got to cover this section of history, and you have to do whatever this little science lesson is. Mm-hmm. But if the teacher really knows the kids, they know what they're into. Are they into Transformers? Are they into sword fights? Are they into pretty princesses? Whatever it is that they're into, say they're into baseball, whatever it is, like, can the best way to do it is if you can come up with a theme for the class, and then you use the elements that you have to teach. Okay, you got to get your fractions in there, but does it have to be completely isolated from absolutely everything else that you're teaching?
Right.
And can you make an integrated lesson that will hit all those things and then integrate it again? So you're kind of looping in, you're kind of diving down into isolated tasks. Sometimes you just got to do your math facts. That's all you know. Sometimes it's just, you know, you need to know your multiplication tables. But now when you go apply it, does it have to be about multiplying stars in the constellation? Or maybe it can all – maybe those problems can all work together in a common theme. So when the kids go to school, when you say, hey, what did you learn in school that year? They might remember that was the year we did baseball, or that was the year we did Middle Ages, or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And sure, they learn – you can't just throw out the facts. You can't just be like, you know, we live in a world where we don't need multiplication facts. I mean, you need to hit the map test, but everything's in a silo. And these teachers are under such pressure to just hit those high notes for the bubble test, because what's on the bubble test? It doesn't say tell me how math works throughout baseball and give eight examples. It's just endless addition and long division. And that teacher isn't going to be judged by how well the parents are involved in the lessons, or how much the teachers or the kids will always remember that year or that teacher. That's not how they're judged. They're how well did they do on that bubble test? So what's the teacher going to do? Just hammer away at the bubble test? Of course they are.
Right.
But
what you're describing is just, you know, sound teaching methodology.
Exactly. And it's not magic. It's correct teaching.
But it doesn't fit the curriculum.
Exactly.
So well, with you. That, sorry, you can't do that.
Right.
I think he's also alluding to curriculum diversity there. And you get that at private schools.
Right.
And Rob, let me clarify my position. I'm not anti-public school. I went to public school all my life until college.
Your marching band wasn't as good as mine, though.
Actually, it was better. Where did you go?
Oh, my marching band was awful. Lindbergh.
Well, we weren't in the... Yeah, right. Well, now it's better.
That's right. It just took us a while.
Point is, the marching band, that was a big player for me. And if I had gone to a private school, I wouldn't have had that experience. So not everything is bad at public schools, Rob. I'm not saying shut them all down, but I'm saying there are some problems with, like we were just talking about, how you have to stick to the curriculum so strictly that kids are missing out on interests that they have, and so they're getting bored and just...
Oh, sure.
Then they fall to the C average and...
Okay, so...
Through life.
What I heard you just say is that there would be no marching bands without public school.
No, that's not what I said.
Okay.
The marching band I was in was a good marching band. We were competitive. I had opportunities because of that. I ended up being drum major, and that was way out of my comfort zone, but it pushed me in a direction I may not have gone.
Okay.
As far as succeeding. The other private high schools around here, had I gone to one of those, they didn't have good marching bands. They were terrible. So yeah, I don't know.
My public school.
Yeah.
Okay. But yeah, it's correlation, not causation. I mean,
right.
You went to public school. Your public school happened to have a competitive marching band.
Right. Because we had a good teacher. There were other high schools around, public high schools, that their band directors were just phoning it in and
But it's not a function of it being a public school, then. It's just...
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Okay.
Listen, maybe I'm not clarifying this. All I was trying to say to Rob was that, because this goes back to a cynical comment, was that I'm not saying burn down the public schools. That's not my position. I had a good experience. I went to a good school, a good public school. It happened to have a good marching band that was very important to me and put me on a pretty good path in life.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying about... I'm not making any hard and fast rules about public schools and band, and therefore a child will succeed.
Fair enough.
Right. And maybe this is a good example, if we want to pay tribute to this, because Jeremy's band teacher, who we said was very good, happened to go from his school to my school. Total coup. Total coup occurred. And because my school's band was awful. We were last place in everything. And then I don't know how it happened, but somehow we ended up with this guy, and the band just took off. Now they're tops in the city.
They've marched in the Rose Parade twice.
Twice. And we couldn't even march down the street when we were in our
Sadly, this guy passed away last March.
Oh. Yes, this podcast is like a tribute that's come up.
Yeah, it was a remarkable story. It was unfortunate that the St. Charles School District did not see his value and did not keep him.
Right,
and Lindbergh did.
Right. How do you keep that teacher? Like, that guy was like, I mean, that guy was like. I don't even know who's the top NFL coach. I don't know, Mike Tomlin or someone. You know, that guy was like the top pick. Like once, if anybody could have their pick of who they wanted in the St. Louis area to run their music program, he would have been the top pick. But whatever happened, they probably couldn't keep him for whatever reason. I mean, they should have paid him.
It was a salary cap.
Yeah, it was a salary cap.
I think it was salary. It was funding. I mean,
they had
to
trade him.
It's because the funding model is broken. It's because their funding changes with the whims of the political community,
right?
Or
and they couldn't keep them.
Correct.
Right, but it wasn't because
other thing I meant to say before we move on and start talking about the funding a little bit regarding curriculum diversity. I worked at Deerberg's in high school, and I had friends who went. There was one girl who went to Coryhazu, and a couple guys went to CBC and SMET and whatever else. And one of the girls in particular was a St. Joe's Academy student. And somehow I saw she had some black and white pictures in the backseat of her car. And I asked her about it. She said, oh, I'm taking a photography class.
Wait, where's the story going?
I wasn't in the backseat of her car. We were both out collecting carts. You know, we were on cart duty.
Oh, okay.
And we happened to pass by her car, and I asked her about it. And she said, oh, yeah, I'm taking a photography class. And here she is, a sophomore or junior in high school, and that was an option she had at her school, private school.
Right.
And she's not a photographer now, but still it was an interest and she took it. Or maybe she thought it would be easy and just wanted to, you know, have a class where she could skate a bit. I don't know what was driving her to take that, but I didn't have an option to take a photography course.
Well, I did. I mean, for the record, my public high school had a photography class. So
see, there you go. All right.
And I also, just since we've all been talking about burning down schools, I just wanted to point out that I'm not advocating that we burn anything down either.
No, okay, good, good.
The public schools should be auctioned off to any private company school out of them.
Well, but that alludes to the whole charter school thing where, memory serves me right, where that's not working out so well either.
Well, the charter school isn't really a private school, though. It's still part Correct. Of the public school district. It's still under the, you know, under the thumb, if you will, of, you know, the superintendent and all of the administration, all the burden associated with that. So, I'm not a fan of charter schools either. It's at least a baby step in the right direction, but it's not the solution.
How do we serve that juicy middle, though, that Rob, that I agree that my children will succeed at some marginal level because their mother and I find it important to help them succeed in their educational endeavors.
Right.
But if I were, I don't know, Joe Sixpack, I might not care that much about it. Or I wouldn't be able to afford the luxury of helping my children succeed.
Okay. Well,
how do you reach those people? Is it all through charity, which I know you're kind of a fan of, instead of being social services type stuff?
Well, you know, the Joe Sixpack that we're talking about here, that... Mm-hmm. I understand that shorthand for a whole series of problems, you know, social problems that we have of absentee parenting and whatnot.
Correct.
I don't believe school is a solution to that problem in any capacity. So
correct.
It's not really fair to pose the question that way, in my opinion.
Okay. But don't we expect that of our public schools now? Anyway,
yes.
So, I mean, don't we expect them to solve all social ills yes. that are dumped on their lap?
Yeah, and I think that's unfair to the schools, to the people who run the schools. It's just, you know, it's an unreasonable expectation.
Correct. Agreed.
So does that open up a No Child Left Behind discussion or no?
Oh, go for it.
No, I don't have...
I know we've talked about it briefly on the show in the past, and... You know, I think it's universally hated by most teachers. Certainly every teacher I've ever known or talked to about that in particular has expressed a distaste for that.
Bob Spiegelman was a band director that Rob and I were talking about, and he was not a fan of that. I don't remember. We had discussions about it, but I don't remember what he said specifically.
Yeah.
He was not a fan.
I wanted to... circle back just a little bit on Bill's question before about the Joe Sixpack, because I think it is a valid question to ask, how does Joe Sixpack, let's say they're lower income, how does he afford to pay for educating his children? Okay. Let's ignore for the moment that he should not have more children than he can afford to raise.
Correct.
So, you know, let's assume that he's made at least, you know, one good judgment call in his life and only has, you know, the minimum number of children he can afford.
Correct.
But, I mean, how much do you really think it costs to educate a kid?
I don't think it costs that much. What I do think is the opportunity cost if it's not the current system. I guess what I am saying, because I'm staring at it in the face, a massive change in household income and lifestyle is necessary if you don't have a public school system.
Yeah, I thought this was kind of a narrow topic, but man, even once you get going, you have funding models and curriculum flexibility. And
oh, yeah.
Something I recently learned about funding in schools, you know, anytime there's a casino that's wanting to get a license, they say, well, it's for the schools, you know.
Right.
Think of all the tax money for the schools. But apparently there is a funding cap. If the schools are fully funded, then that money goes elsewhere. So there's already all this tax money that's going to the schools, and then the casinos roll in, and with the fallacy that there's going to be this major windfall for the schools, and it doesn't quite work that way. And I don't pretend to know all the rules, but they're gaming what they're telling the public is not the real story about how much of casino taxes, fees, whatever they collect, go to the schools.
So what do you think is it some small percentage or is it?
I have no guess whether it's 30 or 70. I don't have a guess, but it's not we're the good guys coming in to rescue your schools. It's, I don't think that's the story they're selling it to the voters that way. And I'm not opposed to casinos. I don't see why gambling is illegal to begin with, along with a lot of other things. But
right.
But I don't like when they're selling something that way. I don't like that in any arena. I mean,
right. Just, typical tactic, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bait and switch. All right. Well, so my question before was, are you saying that if one of those, you have the two parents with low income, if one of them has to stay home to take care of the kids, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think that it's almost inevitable that there will have to be someone present to at least maintain some level of care and education, maybe, for the children if they are not provided for by the state any longer. I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. I'm just saying it is going to be a large change to the normal operating procedure for a significant portion of the populace.
Yeah, I could see that.
And it I don't think it matters if you're low income, median income, or high income. I think the net effect is the same. It may be not as dire if you're making, if you're one of the one percenters or whatever it is, but it can be a big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's cool that you and your family can homeschool, but I don't think that's just like any other service, not everyone can do it. Like I'd love to change my own brake pad, but I don't know what the heck I'm doing down there.
And I don't know. Some days, I spent several days home with my children and I'm ready to bail.
I don't think it's as difficult as many people believe or as many people are led to believe. So I put my conspiracy hat on there briefly, but you teach your kids how to talk, right? You teach them how to tie their shoes. You are a teacher. You've already taught your kids how to do a lot of things. Hmm. So it's just an extension of that, you may not be qualified to teach your kid how to do a triple integral. You might have to go find somebody to help with certain subjects, but you are more there as a coach and as a guide that can help them find the resources they need to learn what they want to learn. I mean, that's your role if you choose to homeschool. So
I'm going to say this with a wink in my voice, but what about all that quality socialization they're missing?
You didn't have to say you had a wink.
Yeah. Well, I think there's plenty of evidence to indict the socialization that occurs now in the public schools. Yes. So that's all I'll say about that.
I just try to spool you up.
I know. Okay, well, I think we are going to take a little break. And then when we come back, we'll jump into some listener feedback from past episode, like 2 episodes ago, actually. To start with some listener feedback here. This goes back to episode 13. Our listener Nathan wrote in and said, talking about the Chris Rock philosophy, figure out a way to live with it, reminds me of a story about Dow Chemical in the 1940s. They were experimenting with nylon stockings. They were the first ones to make stockings out of nylon. They sent a test set of the stockings to a bunch of women at the beginning of summer, and they came back at the end of summer and found that none of the stockings had runs in them. So they redesigned the stockings. So I guess they made them too good the first time. They had to design some flaws into them. Our listener Eric had a few comments on our discussion about cancer treatment, and he said, Rob, you said there's no profit motive in fruit flies right now. I think that's short-sighted. A wonderful book about cancer is The Emperor of All Maladies. Along a similar vein, I highly recommend The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Basically, to buy into, quote, the money is in the medicine argument, you have to believe that not just the companies, but the researchers, doctors, etc., are all part of a grand conspiracy to keep the current process going. This means putting aside their own personal fame and, more importantly, the lives of their families and conceivably themselves. I don't buy it. Cancer isn't a single disease. It has a single treatment. I'd actually love to talk in more detail about this very interesting area.
Yeah, to respond, I'm sure if somebody had the cure and they could make $1 million off it, they wouldn't just like hide it away. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the cure will come from more basic stuff, and that basic stuff doesn't get a profit right now. So the companies who are making the profit are not interested, nor should they be if you're a true free market capitalism guy.
Yeah.
They're not interested in solving it. That's not their job. Their job isn't to solve cancer. Their job is to make money, and they'll do whatever it takes to make the most money. And if that means solve it, well, great. If it means keep it going and sell a bunch of medicine, then that's what they should do. So it goes back to my theorem that I'm all happy with the free market and private enterprise, but we shouldn't force it to or expect it to do more than it should do.
So if it's not their job to cure cancer, whose job is it?
I don't know. Researchers. Kind-hearted researchers.
Non-profit researchers, right?
Right.
And will the researchers solve and cure cancer for poor people and rich people, or just the people who can afford to pay?
All people.
Okay, Rob. I just wanted to make sure I understood who they were.
I don't know how it's going to happen, but I know it's not going to happen. That it's not that the just like we're talking with the stockings, and it's not a free, it's not a private company's job to make breakthroughs. It's not what that's not their goal. If their goal is to make profits.
Go
ahead, Jeremy.
Breakthroughs.
Look at Anheuser profits. Not all the time. Look at Anheuser-Busch with their Bud Light. So they're like the largest beer maker in the universe. Are they making breakthroughs in beer? They're just doing whatever it takes to sell more beer of the same crappy quality. Tasty though.
And that's so tasty.
Their job isn't to make a quality product. Their job is to make money.
Okay.
And those two aren't always the same thing, is what my point is.
Not always in the near term, but long term.
Exactly. So when you come across something like cancer research, then you're talking about near term. Anyway, next topic. Next feedback.
Next slide.
Eric goes on to say the list of rights issue. Jerry, I understand your point about I'll know it when I see it. He's referring to my comment that, you know, rights are kind of comparable to the Supreme Court ruling on obscenity. You can't define it, but you know it when you see it. He says, and I don't entirely disagree, but I think this is part of the problem because you and I may have different ideas about what constitutes rights. For example, taking your example about being on a jury, I believe I have the right to own intellectual property. You don't. We disagree about whether or not the rights of the defendant were violated. I think this would apply in more cases than you are willing to admit. I'm totally willing to admit that jurors would have differences of opinion when it came to things like that. So, you know, worst case scenario, the jury deadlocks on something and they can't agree on a verdict. And, you know, you get a mistrial and you try again. At that point, I guess if it's an issue that's that controversial that, you know, 12 people can't come to some sort of agreement on it, then I don't know. It just seems like it's a bigger problem than, you know, it's something that society as a whole hasn't come to terms with yet. If you can't take this small subset and come to a consensus on it. So I don't know. In that example, if the defendant's on trial for downloading MP3s illegally, yeah, I would definitely vote to acquit because I don't think he's violated anybody's rights. I recognize that I'm in the minority. I might be the only one out of 12 jurors that would vote that way. I don't believe that's always going to be the case, though. Just like, you know, the example we used when we talked about this last, the fugitive slave laws. You know, I'm sure the first few times that went to court, the jury didn't, you know, a minority didn't agree with those laws. Over time, though, it got to the point where they couldn't even enforce the laws anymore because juries just kept acquitting anybody that was accused of violating them. I think the same thing is true in this case. Now, do I have any evidence to back that up? No, that's mostly just my opinion, but take that for what it's worth, I guess. That and $4 will get you a cup of coffee.
You have a right to a cup of coffee? I think that's part of the issue that people are misguided on what rights they fight for.
Yeah.
Or I shouldn't say misguided, but they put the priority in areas that maybe don't need it. Like they have a right to chicken McNuggets and they get hacked off when McDonald's runs out of them. So they call
911. Yeah. Yeah, or, you know, they're brought up in a public school and taught to believe they have a right to health care or they have a right to an education.
Oh, yeah. It had to come to that.
Or the pursuit of happiness or life and liberty. Or...
Yeah, right. So, let's see, where do we go from here? Oh, Eric went on to say, the enslavement by income tax discussion. Well, we do live in a representative democracy where I have some voice, albeit small, in how I'm taxed. Slaves don't have that voice. And there's a lot of leftist liberals who don't mind the taxes to pay for the social programs that the government provides. Heck, even Warren Buffett wants to be taxed more, right? It's the price of civilization, quote unquote. That's fair. Well,
do you really believe what he just said?
I don't know.
Because I don't.
But what's the price? I mean, don't the Swiss pay a higher price than we do? Do they? Are they more civilized?
Yes.
That's not a one-word answer question, Rob.
Well, I think
Switzerland's a welfare state.
It's kind of a twisted definition of civilized, in my opinion, because civilized means you don't take things from other people that don't belong to you. And that's what taxation is. So at its core, it's uncivilized. And it doesn't matter what you do with the money. You know, that boils down to a ends justifies the means argument there. Because, you know, if I walk up to you on the street and I hold a gun in your face and say, give me your wallet, and then I say, oh, by the way, I'm donating all your money to the Red Cross. Does that make what I did okay?
No, it makes you Robin Hood.
No, it makes me a mugger. It makes me a criminal. It doesn't matter what I do with the money. I took it from you at gunpoint. So I can do all kinds of good things with that money, but it doesn't change the fact that I stole it from you.
Instead of gunpoint, they just make you fill out a W-4 now, right?
Yeah.
Civilized.
The gun is implied.
Yeah.
Okay, so you guys got any hot topics that you want to talk about in our last few minutes here?
They found a bunch of planets back in my space. You finally start that civilization, tax-free civilization I've always wanted.
Our new segment is the Planet of the Week.
That's W-E-K.
So, oh, one thing I wanted to mention.
New Hampshire and... Anyway, go on. Sorry, Jerry.
What?
No, I was just saying maybe we should mention what's been happening with the presidential race. But go on with what you were going to say.
Oh, yeah. No, hold that thought. We'll come back to that. But I just wanted to throw this out real quick. The political quiz that we took several episodes ago, Jeremy took it as well, and I'll be including a link in the show notes to his results. But suffice it to say, he's an imposter as well. He's
imposter.
He's not representing the right wing as we had hoped. He's pretty much dead center in the libertarian quadrant.
So why is it so hard to find a good Republican?
Are that an oxymoron, Rob? According to your type,
they're all good.
A good Republican.
Rob is also an imposter, though. He just plays the part.
Yeah. Well, Bill, you're going to have to take the quiz as well, and we'll see where you fall.
I have some problems with that quiz. I have taken it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, but the answers are so much hinges on the answer to one question that I
that makes you a leftist.
I didn't like that. I didn't like that either.
It makes me a leftist.
Because that's the way I am. I think if you're if you're more like some of the right wing people I know, they're just like, or like Jerry, I mean, you just click right down the side, easy, you know.
Yeah, for cannot me, I wanna, do that. No.
For me, I want like a 10-page essay answer.
I thought that was the liberal arts major in me, but maybe right. It is the leftist yeah. in me. I don't know.
Right. Maybe write a poem.
Haiku.
Yeah, I'll play a song. Write a musical about it.
So yeah, let's talk briefly about the primaries. We talked about in our last episode, we had our predictions of who was going to win in Iowa. I think we were all wrong.
Yep.
No one predicted Rick Santorum's race from behind to sorry.
No pun intended.
to almost win, right? 8 votes shy of winning.
God help us if he wins. That
Well, I can tell you why he's not going to win, which is because he didn't gloat enough about almost beating Romney. I mean, don't if you vote for somebody and you vote for them, don't you expect them to go rub it in your face a little bit? Go, told you.
Yeah, victory lap.
Yeah, I told you I didn't. I wanted him to break out into, you know, MC Hammer, you can't touch this, when that happened.
So how about Ron Paul? Where does he go from here? He had a fairly strong showing in New Hampshire. Certainly did better than the last time he was there. He only got 9% of the vote in 2008. Got 20, almost 23% this time. Third time's a charm, right?
Kind of get the feeling he's headed back to Middle Earth, that he's losing steam, which is unfortunate.
Why do you feel that way?
Partly press coverage. Mm.
You think everybody's so busy just chasing Romney?
Yeah.
Well, they don't give him a real shot. Yeah, I think he's kind of a fake candidate of some sort.
Yeah, well,
Kelly Clarkson gave him a shot. I don't know why the rest of us can't. What happened to Newt? Where did he go? He was so much fun.
Is he fun just because you want to make fun of him, or? Because
he says things that make me wonder how he got to be a candidate in the first place. And that's why I enjoy him. I enjoy someone saying crazy
He's the
things.
Comic relief.
Yeah, because he asks, number one, he either asks pointed questions that make people squirm, or he asks ridiculously crazy things that make me laugh. And I miss that in the presidential election process.
Yeah, now that we don't have Herman Cain to kick around anymore.
Oh, yes. Or Michelle Bachmann, for that matter. She needs to go eat some more hot dogs or corn dogs or whatever that is. And
I think Newt's got he's my favorite, or one of my favorite right-wing minds. Like, I like the things that he thinks about and the goofy stuff he says. Like, he kind of makes me think more than most of these jokers, but he's a terrible candidate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so he needs to get back to just, like, saying funny stuff on Sunday shows.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think this is all a money-making scheme for him. I think he can't even envision a President Gingrich.
Yeah, that's hard for me to wrap my mind around as well.
Sounds like something out of Monty Python. Turn him into Gingrich. A newt. I got better.
I still say this is the best we've got to offer. That's the question.
Yeah.
Maybe somebody will come up.
It's terrible, man. It's just terrible. So I got a couple of I'll put these links in the show notes. These are stories that were just in the news in the last day or two, and I'm always looking for examples of, you know, why government doesn't work, why it continues to fail us, and I thought these were pretty good examples. First of all, it's a story about whooping cranes that have been cleared for takeoff by the FAA. And that title really tells you all you need to know about that story. So I'll just let you click it and read it yourself.
Mm-hmm. Does that have anything to do with that movie Fly Away Home?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's somehow involved, but
yeah,
it does involve ultralights. So
yeah. They did clear it, because I thought they were telling the guy he had to quit doing what he was doing.
Well, funny that it really came down to taxes.
That's not all. It's, yeah.
Because the FAA was claiming that the pilots who perform that task are getting paid for it, and therefore they, you know,
they have to be a commercial pilot.
Yeah. And they didn't have the license. So So yeah, I'll let you read the story yourself, but I just thought it was funny that the FAA is involving itself in whooping cranes and their migration patterns.
Well, they've perfected the airlines, so probably time to move on to something else.
Everything's smooth here, let's move on.
And the second story was just, it was in the Post about a highway bill being on the fast track in the Missouri Senate. And it's just one line in the story that struck me about how, you know, if Missouri doesn't act quickly on this, they risk losing their federal highway funds. And it, you know, it's just so painfully obvious to me that this is extortion. You know, the federal government is extorting, blackmailing the states into doing their bidding. And if they don't, then, you know, no funding for you, no highways for you. And I just, you know, I'm tired of that. I'm tired of hearing about the federal government.
What was the funding for? Was it related to the new bridge? Are we going to end up with a half-finished bridge between here and Illinois?
It wasn't funding for anything in particular. It was just like $10 million in highway funds that the state stood to lose if they didn't, you know, adopt the federal mandates on, I think it was drunk driving standards, and there was another thing. But, you know, it just, you know, let's shred the 9th and 10th Amendments. They're not important. You know, the federal government is all powerful. The states have no rights.
I think that's why I liked the states who turned down some of the stimulus money. There weren't many who did it.
Yeah.
The few that did, I was kind of wanted to send them a fruit basket or something.
Well, didn't banks that turn down the stimulus money get it shoved down their throat and stuff? I mean, like TARP money and stuff wasn't. It's amazing to me what you can be forced to do by the federal government.
Yeah, we could do a whole episode just on that, probably.
Absolutely. And it's scary when I agree sometimes.
Rob, what do you got? Take us home.
Nothing.
You got nothing.
You promised.
Yes.
I told you that was a failing strategy.
Yeah, we were counting on you for the big finish.
I'll have a big start next time.
Rob, you should be talking about, well, that's not political or any real social issue, but it kind of is, being that your wife was related to the symphony. Did you hear about the conductor who stopped a 25-minute piece because some idiot's cell phone kept going off in the audience?
Good for him.
It's a pretty incredible story. Maybe I'll send a link for the show notes.
Yeah, send that to me. All right, everybody. We appreciate you listening. We obviously appreciate our listeners, since two of them are on this show.
We might be the only two.
Yeah, there might not be any others out there. I don't know. We appreciate your feedback, too. So like I said at the top of the show, give us your comments. We'd love to hear from you. Make it a point of sending us an email at the very least. Send us an email. feedback@midwestpeaceprocess.com. Just say hi. Let us know you're listening so we get a feel for how many regular listeners we've got out there. We'd appreciate it. We'll call this a census, you know, so that we can start taxing you.
Yep. There you go.
Nice.
And of course, if you're on Facebook, visit our page, facebook.com/MidwestPeace. And I know that doesn't do Bill any good. He's very anti-Facebook.
Anti, I say.
We should probably all be anti-Facebook, actually. All right. Bye, everybody.
Good night. Good night.
Rick Santorum, the surprise finisher in Iowa's three-way tie last night, is no friend of limited government. He says so himself. Listen to this radio clip.
One of the criticisms I make is to what I refer to as more of a libertarian-ish right. They have this idea that people should be left alone, be able to do whatever they want to do. Government should keep our taxes down and keep our regulations low, and that we shouldn't get involved in the bedroom. We shouldn't get involved in cultural issues. That is not how traditional conservatives view the world. There is no such society that I'm aware of where we've had radical individualism and that it succeeds as a culture.
No such society, he says, has succeeded as a culture. Our next guest says Santorum is totally wrong about that. There is such a society. It's called the United States of America. David Bowes from Cato joins us now. David, it's a pleasure. Welcome back to Freedom Watch.
Thank you, Judge.
Make the case against Rick Santorum that is really just a Republican version of big government. No friend to those who believe in the Constitution. No friend to those who believe in fiscal conservatism. No friend to those who believe in small government.
Well, I think you and he have just done it. I mean, it really is stunning that here is a candidate, I don't know of any other politician other than Rick Santorum and Hillary Clinton, who have directly attacked the idea of the pursuit of happiness. It's in the Declaration. It's the fundamental idea of America, and they're the only two who have criticized it openly. He says the pursuit of happiness is harming America. And I think you go from that, you see that he wants to regulate society. He wants government in the bedroom. He wants government in your religious life, but also his record in the Senate. He voted for No Child Left Behind. He right. voted for steel tariffs. He voted for the prescription drug entitlement. He voted against NAFTA. He has a mixed record in the Senate, but a lot of big government conservatism there.
Is it going to be left to Ron Paul to capture the votes of Republicans who feel like you do? Is it going to be left to Gary Johnson running on a libertarian ticket to capture the votes of those who feel as you and I do? How is this going to shake down? It seems to me to be an overwhelming urge in the Republican Party that none of these guys is the person that we want to be the standard bearer.
Libertarians and Tea Partiers and constitutionalists and people who believe that government's gotten too big don't have many choices right now. We're being told that the choice is between Mitt Romney, who, you know, has the health care mandate on his record, and Rick Santorum, who openly dislikes the fundamental political idea of America. So, yes, I would think that people who are looking for smaller government don't have many choices besides Ron Paul and Gary Johnson. We'll see how that plays out. But these two so-called front runners are big government conservatives, and it could be four more years of George W. Bush.
Got it. David Bowes from the Cato Institute. Always a pleasure, my friend. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.